Good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings, and again this week I'm joined by our co-host Mona Hill.
Hello, everybody. I'm here, too.
And we've got two guests today. We were expecting one, but we got two bonus. We've got Barb Lawrence, Executive Director of Regina's Street Workers Advocacy Project, or SWAP, it's better known by, I guess, and with a former board member, Mary Rassette. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
I've been really trying to get Barb to come on my show for a while, and you finally agreed to come on because I believe that SWAP is such a needed agency in Regina, as any agency that works with people who live on the street, who work on the street, in any city is. And I think it's really, really a good thing that you're here. And Mary, I'd like to welcome you here too.
Thank you.
As a former board member, how long have you been involved with SWAP, Mary?
Oh, for a lot of years. I think at least the last 10 years,
okay,
for sure.
How long has the agency been around, Barb?
It'll be 16 years in July.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been a director since it started?
No, I came on as a practicum student in the fall of 1994. And then towards the end of my term, the lady who was the current project coordinator decided she was going back to school. So with my practicum ending, they had asked me if I would stay on.
So. That's wonderful. Yeah. So there's a whole group of women now. They are sort of congregating and getting their education later in life like I did, too. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been there now for how long?
Well, about 15 and a half years.
Oh, is that right? So you went from being a practicum student to being the director immediately?
At that time, originally, the title was project coordinator.
Okay.
We were essentially set up as a pilot project, and we had come under the umbrella of Circle Project for the first year or so before we incorporated as a separate entity.
Okay.
But at that time, I came on as a project coordinator when Val Desjardins left, and we had an advisory committee that was comprised of. Some people were from the street. They had worked in street prostitution. There were some representatives of some of the funders and other community agencies. But again, as I say, we came under the umbrella of Circle Project in terms of managing our administrative functions.
Okay.
I think it was about a year or so later that we incorporated separately and set up our own board of directors. And over time, we changed some of the titles of the positions.
Right. And speaking of board of directors, Mary, you were on the board of directors at one time.
Yes, I was.
I'm really interested in that because I've been on a number of boards in my life, and I've been asked to be on some boards. And what interests me is a particular agency like SWAP. What would interest someone in becoming a board member, with wanting to be so involved in an agency like SWAP?
Well, I think my interest certainly came because, first of all, I came from the streets myself.
Okay.
And I am an ex-street worker.
Mm-hmm.
So I became involved with SWAP strictly at first, just seeing the van out.
Oh, there's a van?
Yeah, utilizing the services of the van. And once I became more acquainted with SWAP and got to know Barb, and then decided to quit doing what I was doing, I became involved as a board member, and I've certainly been awakened to a lot of things, and once becoming an employee, I then again was really awakened to what's going on and what's happening.
Okay, so you were hired on as an employee as well?
Yes.
After that, okay. Mm-hmm. So what was going on? What was happening?
Well, you know, I hadn't realized the services that, even as a board member, I really had, when I was a board member, I was really looking into bylaws and different things. I wasn't really looking as a member at the services provided. And it wasn't until I became an employee and was at that desk that I witnessed what was really going on in the services that were provided and to all the different types of circumstances that were happening among people who were coming from the streets and how they were handled. It was a real eye-opener. The services were just needed, really, really needed. And there was no judgment there. And the people that lived in poverty or the undereducated people and people coming from the streets, they're a different type of person altogether, as I was. Mm-hmm. And so SWAT provided the type of service that had that compassion and that non-judgmental. And if I didn't feel good today or if my thinking wasn't positive thinking, SWAT understood that. Uh-huh. Whereas if I was going to take a course someplace else, that understanding wouldn't have been there.
Right. Absolutely. So I'm just so impressed with that. To hear that is because that is what's needed for people in sort of dire straits and on a daily basis, crisis on a daily basis, I think.
Perhaps I should mention, Mona, that when SWAP was first kind of prior to the actual creation of the organization, there was a lot of frustration in the city around the issue of prostitution and the community's inability to address it. That seemed to create a willingness within the powers that be to look at maybe addressing this issue in a different way. So what happened is there was a small committee that was formed. They found some funding to hire two researchers to go out into the street and talk to the women. So it was a different way of just approaching the issue. It wasn't the police or the mm-hmm. agency directors or the social workers determining what the issue or problem was and what the solutions were. These researchers spent 4 months out on the street talking to those that were working and asked them about what their issues were, how they saw things, what led them to the street, what kept them there, what were some services and programs that they think or would be helpful to them. So that recognition that there was an invaluable expertise within this population is something that we have strived very hard to continue within the organization, and it's fundamental to the type of organization that we are. We have in our bylaws one that stipulates that at least 51% of our board members must be people who have worked in street prostitution.
I was going to ask about that.
Now, the number has always been much higher than that.
Okay.
The majority of our board members have typically been those who have worked in street prostitution mm-hmm. because they are truly the experts on their lives and on the issues, the circumstances, the needs. And I think sometimes we tend, as service providers, to forget that in our well-meaning efforts, and in our education, we think we're perhaps in a better position to determine what those needs are and what the solutions
are. And what the best solutions
are. Exactly.
Right.
And,
according to our kind of worldview.
Well, and that's the challenge for us because, as I've come to realize over the years, my worldview has been vastly, vastly altered through my work and my experiences at SWAP. The street world is totally different. It is such a different world. And when we come in from the outside and try and impose our solutions on this population, we're so misinformed. It doesn't mean that I think people come to this with the best of intentions. But unfortunately, the best of intentions, if they are not well informed, can often be disastrous. And I think we've seen this over the years in a wide variety of areas. So it's something that is, as I say, fundamental to the organization of recognizing the knowledge, the wisdom, the experience that those we work with have and encouraging their participation at the organization at all levels, whether it's on the board, as staff members, mm-hmm. volunteers. It's who we are.
Right. Street world being so vastly different than people not living on the streets. How did people end up living on the streets, Barb? I mean, I'm sure everybody has their own individual story, But is there a sort of a, I hate to say this, is there sort of a box that you can check off? You know, to say these particular issues are ones that cause people to live on the streets, in particular women, because I know that prostitution is more prevalent amongst women for particular reasons. So is there something that's particular to that, why they end up living on the street, other than the fact that there's hardly anywhere to live in Regina?
Well, I think there are some perhaps generalities we can make, because I do believe, as you said, everybody's story is different. Everybody is very unique. But what we find in this community in terms of the population that we work with is that the vast majority are Aboriginal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our history has a very significant impact on that in terms of the deprivation that Aboriginal people in this province and perhaps in this country have experienced over the years of colonization.
That was the word that was on my lips.
But it's a deprivation that's so profound. It's in terms of their spirituality, their economic independence, their cultural ways,
self-identity,
their sense of identity and self-worth. It has been just massive, the destruction, and we're living with the consequences of this today.
Yeah.
People who have had little or very few opportunities to for education, to gain employment skills, people's who not only their individual lives, family lives have been decimated, but that their communities have been decimated, and the impacts of those, the trauma, the violence, it's turned inward, and you often find that in marginalized groups, that the powerlessness that they feel, the only place they have power is back within that marginalized group,
right,
and it's led to many, many significant problems that have impacted this population, and we see it on the streets of Regina, we see it on the streets, I'm sure, of Saskatoon and many other large cities in the country. And I guess what's I often think with SWAP, you know, it's like we just try to provide opportunities for people when they're ready, and the support and the encouragement. You know, we try to access resources in order to be able to offer services and programs that people have identified that are important to them. But it's really long-term work. I mean, we have a community of people who, it's not a lifestyle. This is their life. This is all they've known, is the poverty, the hardships, the deprivation, the violence, the addictions. It's been their life since they were born.
Right.
And
there's oftentimes people have the attitude that everyone has choices to make. But if you've never known, there's another choice.
Well, and I think you'll find that it's people of privilege who think that.
Yeah,
we all have the same kinds of choices.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly didn't come from a family that I would consider particularly privileged. But at the same time, in the context within which I work, I recognize that I had significant privileges. The color of my skin being one, the values of my community being another. I didn't come from a community whose values were torn apart,
right?
Whose families were torn apart,
right?
So
whose parents or grandparents were thrown in jail,
exactly,
for their spiritual beliefs and absolutely.
Or from a community that was undervalued or devalued,
right?
As having no importance and no contribution to make to the rest of the world.
So. How do you feel about that, Mary?
You know, certainly what Barb says is true. When I hear what she's had to say about that, I was raised in foster home, and certainly my color was brought up a number of times. The word Indian was brought up a number of times.
And I'm assuming not in a positive context.
Exactly. And then having to go through and lived through abuses, emotional abuses, sexual abuses at a very young age. And then lack of education, low self-esteem, addictions. I certainly qualify for just about everything that Barb has mentioned.
Yeah. Addictions it's a really huge issue for a lot of people living on the streets, isn't it?
Well, I think addictions is a huge issue for a lot of us, whether we're living on the street or not, some kind of
point.
Addiction or another. But yes, leaving
point.
That one
yeah.
alone.
Yeah.
It is. You know, when you don't feel good about yourself,
yeah.
you know, it drinking, using become ways to bring some type of normalcy into your life, to give you some sense of being okay, or else simply just of numbing out. And it's
pain.
The numbing out,
yeah.
I think, that is more prevalent.
Right.
In fact, we were just doing a presentation at the office to a group of high school students, and we had about four presenters, and I think that's a common theme in terms of people's using. You know, you feel like crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have no hope. You've experienced all the trauma since birth.
Mm-hmm.
It's all around you. It's a normal lifestyle in your community, in your family, amongst your friends. It's a way of coping. It's a way of surviving. It becomes a tool.
Absolutely.
And when you don't have any hope that life can be any different for you than it is for anybody around you, then it is. It becomes very, very normalized.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it becomes one more, you know, it's like many survival skills. They can be helpful in certain contexts, but they also have a downside to them.
That's interesting you should say that, because I've worked with people who have sort of multiple addictions and very severe addictions. And at one point someone said to me, the reason I'm still alive is because I drink every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to wrap your head around that is not an easy thing to do when you don't suffer from addictions yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because the concept of, you know, of killing yourself from drink or killing yourself from using drugs is easy to understand, but to actually the concept of surviving because you do that is not easy to understand. But I got it.
Mm-hmm.
I understood it after
yeah.
a while. They helped me to understand yeah. that, because maybe if you're not using, you're going to kill yourself because it's just too painful.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we see that every day
yeah.
as well.
Right. So in your programming, maybe you could speak to this, Mary. When you first went to SWAP, you talked earlier about seeing the van go out. What was the van doing, and what did it mean to you to see the van?
Actually, when I first saw the van, I was certainly embarrassed about what I was doing, so I would hide from it.
Okay.
After finding out what the van was all about, I was just so... SWAP, when the van came, it represented safety for me. It was a safety net for me, number one. I knew that if something would happen, that the van was going to come along sooner or later, and I could report if anything went wrong. I could report something that was going on. It took away a lot of the fear of being, especially late at nights, being on the streets alone on a corner.
So there was no way you could count on the police for help, I'm gathering.
No, I'm afraid that police weren't, that wasn't an agency I was going to turn to.
I wanted to ask that question so that people, our listeners, understand this. It's important that they understand.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really unfortunate, but I mean, maybe it's just part of the dynamic, you know, specific to prostitution. You know, when people are engaged in an activity that has become criminalized, I mean, it's a natural setup for a bit of an antagonistic relationship between any police service. Now, there are wonderful, wonderful people in the Regina City Police Service.
As I know, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And very caring people and very competent people. But it's kind of that institutionalized relationship. You know, and if people get charged or busted or other things happen, even unrelated to prostitution. And again, you know, part of our history is a relationship between authority and Aboriginal communities, where many people in the Aboriginal communities feel that justice is never done.
not for them.
Is never perceived to have happened.
Right.
And often they feel that they are re-victimized and re-victimized again and again and again. So those kinds of situations do not help create good relationships necessarily,
right,
or a sense that people are there for me. They're there to protect me.
Right.
You know, which you know, I think mainstream society views
exactly
institutions such as that yeah, way. But on the other side of the fence, when you're on that other side of the fence, it's a totally
different
world that many people have.
Yeah. So what did the van do in the place of, and what type of safety did it provide? You were talking about being able to report when things weren't right.
Right. If there was a bad day, you could report that.
Okay.
If an emergency came up, you knew that they would be there. They would be able to take you to hospital or wherever. They provided me with condoms for protection.
Okay.
There was just a lot of that, and sometimes it was just someone to talk to.
Oh yeah.
I was having a problem, and I might have been lonely that night, or I might have been depressed or upset,
right,
about what I was doing or going through.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was just somebody to talk to just for a while, and they were there for that.
Sometimes that could be the most important thing, have somebody to talk to and understand and not judge you.
Yeah. And I think that's pretty much fundamental to the street outreach program. It's while, you know, the most obvious focus is on harm reduction through the provision of condoms and bad date sheets, which contain information that workers give us on anybody that's caused them any type of harm while they're working on the streets, so any bad dates that they have. And they give us the information, description of the vehicle, incident, individual, and we just put that back into pamphlet form and distribute it back out to those who are working, because they have to make very quick decisions whether they're going to get in or not. And the more information they have on people who may be predators or
mm-hmm,
cause them harm, then,
right,
then, you know, hopefully the safer they can be. But the other part, and there's also the crisis intervention, as Mary said, the informal counseling. But it's really a lot about building relationships as well.
Right.
And if people can build that kind of relationship with your outreach staff, eventually they will start to come into the drop-in center, just
yeah,
based on that relationship, yeah, and that feeling of safety and respect.
Right.
And I have found that respect is incredibly important. People that we work with have received so little of that.
Right.
And their response is amazing. You know, they just, their appreciation when you show them respect is truly just amazing. And that's all, you know, that's all they ask for. You know, it's just to be treated with respect. And it's so simple. Makes such a difference.
It kind of takes me back to what you said earlier about the understanding or the misunderstanding about the privilege of color in many respects, because we often believe, we don't even think about that we should be respected. We don't even, you know, if somebody disrespects me in any way, I'm incensed. But if you've never been respected, I can see it. Mm-hmm. You need a lot of time. I know you need a lot of time to build that respect and that trust.
Well, I think with privilege also comes the danger of taking a lot of things for granted.
Yes.
You know, but when you're living in survival mode, you can't afford to take anything for granted.
Right. So who do you trust? Yeah. So somebody who's there all the time becomes somebody to trust.
Well, and I think that's it. We've been there through thick and thin, you know, good, bad, and indifferent. You know, we've been able to maintain that service, that presence on the street.
How much time have we got, Jim?
Oh, we got about 3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. So the van, is the van still around? Do you still use it?
Yes, it is. We're only out 4 nights a week now, and again, that's a funding issue.
Funding.
We should be out at a minimum 6 weeks, or 6 nights a week. We're out there between the hours of 8:30 and 1 o'clock in the morning. If something comes up later on and we have to be out there later, we are. There's a staff person and a volunteer in the van, and normally the volunteers are somebody from within our target population. It kind of makes them feel they have a contribution to make,
mm-hmm,
when they can sit inside the van,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to being a recipient,
yeah,
of service on the street. So
right,
it really, it's, and it also gives us a chance to spend time with them if the night's a little bit slow, and, you know, talk,
mm-hmm,
and just to offer some encouragement and support. So, yeah, so we're out there right now 4 nights a week, and we just spend the evenings driving through the areas where people are working.
Do you have any estimate? You must have an estimate right now of approximately how many people are working on the streets in Regina? on a regular basis?
Yeah, we're just completing our final statistics. So I'm a rough guess here. I'd say between 150 and 180. And some of those are relatively sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are some people that are out there quite regularly. But
what's the youngest you've seen?
Probably about 13.
13, 12, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to continue this conversation because I think it's a conversation people need to hear about. I think most people sort of maybe drive by your building on Albert Street and see the big SWAP and not have a clue what it's all about. So I want the city to know, I want those listeners to know how important SWAP is and how important the work that you're doing is. And also maybe hear a little bit more about your story, Mary, if you feel like telling us.
Sure.
Okay, so we'll take a break now.
Okay, and so we'll take that break, and we're going to have some music after. We're going to play some Jan Arden.
You can do it, I know you can, I know you will. You can make it, I know you can, get up the hill. We'll be right back.
And we're back, but I'm just going to run down a few things. I got a little sort of housekeeping to do here. We've got to mention CJTR's annual Music Garage Sale, the 2010 edition. And it's this year it's Saturday, June 12th. It's an important fundraiser for community radio, and you can help now by donating merchandise for the event. And we're accepting CDs, DVDs, vinyl records, music books and magazines, sheet music, music instruments and equipment, and anything else music related. You can drop off your donations during regular business hours between Monday and Friday. Our address is number 301 1102 8th Avenue in the Red Brick Building just west of Winnipeg Street, the former GMC building. If a drop off is not possible, you can call us at 525-7274 to arrange for pickup. You make your donation now, please, and thanks for supporting Community Radio CJTR. Another thing that I've got to mention here is that 91.3 FM CJTR is a proud sponsor of the 2010 Cathedral Village Arts Festival. So you're invited to drop by the CJTR Athol Street stage during the street fair on May 29th. And one more thing. What the heck here? I'm on a roll.
Go for it, Jim.
Okay. We want to mention membership. Okay. And we're inviting you to become members of CJTR. It's Regina Community Radio. Membership gives listeners a tangible way to show their support for CJTR and our great alternative multicultural programming. One of the things that you can do is you can help guide the future of the station by participating on committees or on the board, and by attending the annual general meeting. And you can apply to program your own weekly show, just like Mona and I. And so there you go.
And you would love that.
Oh, it is a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. And finally, now we're going to talk about Amnesty International. We're having a steak night, and we're calling it Have a Steak in Human Rights. It's at Bushwhacker Brew Pub at 2206 Dewdney Avenue, Regina. It's Tuesday, June 1st from 5 to 8 p.m. Tickets are $25 in advance. You can get them from me or Mona or anybody from in Amnesty International. You can email gordon.barnes at Amnesty International, Amnesty Saskatchewan, pardon me, gordon.barnes at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or mona.hill at amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Proceeds will go to Amnesty International to support human rights locally, nationally, and globally. And you got steak, you got Caesar salad, you got Bushwhacker fries, and a 12-ounce Bushwhacker beer if you wish, but you don't have to drink beer. Okay.
What can you drink if you don't drink beer?
Well,
pop. There's pop available.
There's pop, there's water,
soft drinks
there's
and water.
Coffee, yeah,
and
tea.
You don't have to eat steak.
Nope.
Right?
That's
there's
right.
Substitutes. You can have veggie burger.
Yep. Or chicken.
Or chicken.
Yep.
But we need to know by the 27th if you want your tickets, because I have to hand in the money and the tickets that are left over by the 27th. And I just wanted to add that Amnesty Regina doesn't do a lot of fundraising, although a lot of you may see us out and about in public at our educational tables. We do a lot of educating, and we try to get out there as much as possible. But as far as fundraising goes, we don't do a lot. So if we can fill this steak night up, that would be very helpful to us to get some extra funds to do our job a little bit more effectively.
And it'll be fun.
And yes, we will have fun. Oh, there'll be a silent auction, and we'll have some 50-50 tickets too. So come on out and enjoy yourself.
Okay, we're done.
Are we done?
Yeah.
Okay, and we're back. And for those of you who weren't here at the top of the hour, we are here with Barb Lawrence and Mary Reset from Street Workers Advocacy Project in Regina, or SWAP. And we're having a really good conversation about what SWAP is doing for people who are working on the streets and who are living on the streets in terms of supportive services and, well, basically all the supportive services that they offer, and having a wonderful relationship and offering safety and somewhere for people who are living and working on the streets to go and feel safe, and to maybe look towards a brighter future for themselves.
I have a question. I was just wondering, are your clients all female, or are there any male street workers out there?
Yes, there are, Jim. Okay. There are males who work in the street, although we have seen the numbers drop off in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But I should also add, while our original mandate and is to work with people involved in street prostitution, over the last quite a few years, we've seen this kind of movement to informally push the boundaries of our mandate to encompass a broader population of just other street-involved people.
Right.
And so we have a much wider population trying to access services and programs through SWAP. And I think that two of the reasons that I've identified, one is that our credibility on the street is very high and has been for years. And we're well known on the street. And the other is that there just simply aren't a lot of services and programs or accessible programs for this population. And while we may have many good programs and services in the community, often there are a lot of kind of subtle barriers for people participating. The people who come into our programs often have both feet still out in the street. They're just kind of starting to maybe take a look at maybe doing something that's pretty tentative. They have all of the issues, all of the challenges of their life with them. And what we have found, in order to be, to provide them or to allow them to be as successful as possible, we need to provide intensive supports for them, not only for a particular program, whether it's an alternative education program or employability program, but it's as much about providing the practical supports they need to deal with those daily living issues that they're struggling with. Because it's really difficult, for example, to concentrate on an education program if you don't know where you're going to sleep that night, or you haven't eaten for 2 days and you don't know when you're going to eat again, or if you're going to go home and you're not sure if you're going to get a beating or not. Or, you know, it's when people are struggling at a basic survival level, you need to be able to provide those intensive supports for them in addition to quote-unquote programming. You just do. And a lot of agencies don't have the resources to do that. And also, I think funders put pressure on agencies as well. Because of the limitations around funding and the expectations in terms of outcomes, working with this population requires a long-term perspective. You know, you're not looking at 6 months or a year. You may be looking at 3, 4, 5 years before people have reached that point of stability where they've built up enough self-esteem, where they've acquired the skills and knowledge they need to be able to move on beyond agencies such as SWAP. This is long-term work that has to be done on a consistent level in order for people to get to the point in life when they're ready to step off beyond this.
Right.
And again, finding the resources for to work as the way that you need to work to be successful with this population is just extremely difficult. So what a lot of agencies do, you know, they'll screen the clients that come in, and you know, if they've got too many issues, too many challenges, they will dissuade them from entering into programs.
Right. You're talking about basic survival stabilization. Right.
Yeah.
I can see the importance of maybe going into a program.
I was just going to say, this is personal economics. This is survival.
Yep.
How do you get along? How do you get money? How do you get food? That sort of thing. I was just reminded, Mona has more history than I do, but I remember being in Vancouver by myself, and I was by no means having any sort of problem. I had parents back home who would send me money if I needed it, but I was on my own and staying at the Y and what. I remember having a conversation with a guy who said, you know, he wasn't in quite as well off as I was. He said, well, if you need $50, there's always somebody who's willing to give it to you. And
but you got to work for it.
I didn't quite understand what he was talking about, but I got it.
Eventually,
So it's economics. You know, how do you survive?
And I think we've, our society, we have different levels of economies within our communities, and some we don't like to talk about, such as the economies that go on at the street level. But but there is a whole economic system there as well. There's a way that people survive with very limited choices, but they do survive. I mean, within each one of us, there is this inherent will to live. And if we marginalize populations and keep them out of them or deny them access to the more mainstream opportunities, they will find another way to survive.
Yeah, well, what I find difficult to understand is why our policymakers don't understand that if you don't do something about this problem, the problem will not go away. You know, you can't ignore it.
Well, I think it's just not the policymakers, Jim. Quite frankly, I think it's more, policymakers, politicians, and let's assume we're all well-meaning, well-intentioned mm-hmm. folks, you know, and half decently educated. I think it's more about a community attitude, a community will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who leads the parade, you know, who really drives things. I mean, the politicians are going to respond to
voters, yep.
and the concerns and issues that are being raised mm-hmm. by the population that votes. Quite frankly, our folks don't vote.
Yeah.
You know, they're invisible. They don't have a voice.
Yeah, that's so often.
It hasn't reached a level of community concern.
Yeah.
We just have yet to develop the attitude that these people are part of our community.
Yeah.
They're part of our successes. They're part of our failures.
So this is a matter of awareness.
Well,
of what
exactly,
it is.
Yeah. And it's about all of us.
Yeah.
You know, it's about not leaving people behind. Are there solutions? Absolutely. Do we know how to work well with disadvantaged populations? Are there other community agencies that know how to do this? Yes, there are.
Mm-hmm.
We know what needs to be done. We know how to do it. The political will isn't there because the community will isn't there as of yet.
Right.
And I'm hoping at some point that will change.
Well, when you get the average citizen in a city that ignores the situation because it's not in their field of vision every day, I can see that happening.
Well, absolutely. And you know, and part of the problem, too, for the community-based agencies, I mean, you're in between being so overwhelmed by just your survival in terms of funding and,
exactly.
and all of the efforts and the time and the pressures that funding takes, and then being overwhelmed by the needs of the people that are coming in your doors. When do you have time to put a lot of effort into building or changing attitudes within the community? We know it needs to be done, but when you have to make really hard choices in terms of where your time commitments are, I know over the past, for me, it's when people are coming in my doors and they need my attention, then something else is going to go.
Exactly.
Because they come first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
And yet it's in some respects it's self-defeatist, because yeah. then it always means you're fighting the short-term battle, mm-hmm. the immediate crisis thing.
Right.
Agencies aren't much beyond that state themselves, the crisis state. And meanwhile, nothing has been done at the broader level.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a very, very difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, didn't that sound positive?
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to something positive. Mary. We have a few minutes left. And how would you feel about sharing some of your story and how you came to end up on the streets? And
well, I landed up being one of the older. I never got on the streets till I was 49
oh
years
my
old.
Goodness.
So that was quite a. And at the time, I was on assistance and couldn't survive.
Right.
I also had addiction problems.
Mm-hmm.
Had to go through that, and I unfortunately had a met who was frequenting a prostitute. I was going through menopause at the time, and I thought, you want prostitute? I'll give you prostitute. So that's how I started prostituting.
Wow.
I landed up in the hospital having a nervous breakdown when I got out. I started drinking, and I started prostituting. And it was quite a, although it wasn't that I was ignorant to the street life.
Yeah.
It was altogether another thing again to be.
It's another aspect of
exactly,
the street life.
Exactly. My sister was on it, so I had knowledge,
okay.
and I knew. But to be part of that and right in was altogether
right.
another scene altogether. But because I was living in poverty as well, it became a part of my life. And it certainly at moments provided a lot of things. It provided food. It provided diapers. It provided a lot of things where I wouldn't have been able to have. That's what prostitution did. It provided
right.
that.
So I'm assuming your education level didn't allow you to go out looking for a good job.
Exactly. You know, I to be honest with you, I've got grade 7 mm-hmm. education.
Right.
And for a lot of years, I told people I had a grade. In fact, I lied about it for so many years, I believed I had a grade 12 education.
Well, I think a lot of people who come from the streets have far more education than somebody who's been to grade 12 and has never lived there. So.
And lived in, like I say, I was a welfare recipient. And there again, I lied again. I didn't want people to know I was on welfare. So I told them I worked for the Department of Social Service payroll department. So, you know,
yeah.
You do what you have to do.
And that stigmatization of being on assistance is part of my past as well. Yeah, and I remember, and it's not very humbling at all. It's just very painful.
Exactly. Yeah. And they certainly, I mean, you're living below the poverty line.
Right.
They say they give you enough, but they certainly don't.
It was never created to allow people to live that way. It's not what it was for. So.
But I think that drives back, you know, it takes us back to the issue of poverty, of economic need, and again, these kind of sub-economies that are created when people feel deprived of access to other opportunities to survive financially out there. So, you know, and we criminalize them. People are in poverty. They're trying to find any way they can to survive, and yet then we criminalize the activities, so on and so forth. It just goes on and on.
Is it actually illegal to prostitute yourself, or is it illegal to...
It's illegal to solicit in a public place.
Yeah.
In a public place.
Now, which is just bizarre.
Well,
it sounds so convoluted.
And the interpretations of that vary widely, and sometimes from place to place, sometimes from judge to judge. There's lots of interesting things around legal definitions, how the law is applied, how it's actually carried out. Lots of very interesting things that happen there. And in terms of human rights, there's lots of issues around that, but... you know, the community seems to, you know, set a standard, and whether, you know, I guess people can debate whether people's human rights are being impinged upon or not, but when you're a marginalized population, who are you going to complain to? How are you going to fight back? You know, is it entrapment? Is it a legal bust? Blah, 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 blah. And how much sympathy are you going to engender if you say, no, this is entrapment? And then how people in the judicial system will interpret that, what their particular, what flexibility their social mores are going to allow, you know, it's...
Absolutely.
I mean,
it's also subjective.
Exactly.
Yes. So your life as a person living on the street is really in the hands of people with subjective opinions about how they're going to judge you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a damn shame. So... Really quickly, you got to make this real quick, but boy, this is a big one. I'm going to throw it at you. I would suspect that, and I could be wrong, that you would both be in favor of legalizing prostitution and having a safe place. Barb's rolling her eyes here. And having a safe place so that somebody can make a decent living at it if they so choose. I mean, and all the things that go along with that. You can just say yes or no, or you can give us, what do we got here, a 1 or 2 minute conversation about that.
I think that's a conversation that would require a bit more time.
Well, then we'll get you back on the show.
Perhaps,
I once was in a debate in university on that. And for me, it was the positive side that yes, we need safe places. I mean, and it does have to do with human rights, in my
opinion.
What
we need are opportunities for people to participate in our community so they do not feel that is the only option for them.
Great.
And when we legalize it or decriminalize it, whatever way we do, we're still suggesting that it's okay to reduce people's choices to a certain level. So I think there's a number of things that need to be considered. It's a complex question.
Oh, sure it is.
It's not an easy answer.
Yeah, and maybe I should apologize for throwing that at you. But, for you to say that is very important because I think for some people who are listening, they've never really thought about that. So it's food for thought for the future that, it's maybe not the answer, legalizing it. How about providing enough enough money. 5 minutes? Okay. How about providing enough economic stability in the first place so that somebody doesn't have to go and do something like that that is so degrading?
Well, and giving them access to educational opportunities,
right,
and environments where they feel, yeah, safe and respected.
Yeah.
Giving them access to occupational training, those,
yeah,
kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know, how about looking at, you know, putting in investments, long-term investments, having a commitment in our community,
right,
to truly providing opportunities for people to not have to,
right,
to be limited to those kinds,
right,
of options in their life. You know,
yeah,
I think, you know, to do one without the other, I think there's a problem there.
Absolutely.
And maybe that's some idealism in there to,
I don't
seem to compromise.
So. I think it's being realistic, actually. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I always go back to, because I've done a lot of work in the area of disability, is, you know, how many people are working on the street because they can't hold a job, or they maybe just would never be able to because of disability, cognitive disabilities, physical disabilities, and there isn't enough support for them regardless of how much we do have in the city. But if you factor in all of the other variables that you've talked about during this whole show, you know, where is that kind of support as well?
Well, I think there's a broader strategy that we can create. The problem is, not doing anything means we just keep on having,
yeah,
the next generation and the next generation and the next generation, whether they suffer from disabilities or the disabilities come after the fact because of the
mm-hmm,
circumstances and the deprivation of,
right,
and trauma that they experience over their lifetime.
Right.
So I think there's multiple levels upon which we need to act around issues such as this.
Absolutely. Do you have any final words, Mary?
Only that it's time to stop sweeping all this under the rug and have a real group, a grassroots level look at all this and do something about it. That funding is necessary for people who have gotten into where they have gotten into and to get them out, for them to be survivors and not victims anymore.
Right. And you are one.
Exactly.
You're an amazing survivor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been wonderful having the two of you on the show.
Thank
We've
you.
Had Barb Lawrence and Mary Reset from the Street Workers Advocacy Project of Regina, or SWAP. And what a great resource. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Mona.
Thank you.
All right. We'll turn it over to you, Jim.
Okay. Well, you're leaving me with about 2 minutes.
Oh, okay.
But
well, you could repeat.
That's fine.
Our steak night information.
Yeah, we'll just run over that again. And I can give you a little more detail here. The mouth-watering, this is what they tell me, mouth-watering 6-ounce sirloin steak, a fresh Caesar salad, awesome Bushwhacker homemade fries, and I love, I'm addicted to those, actually.
Oh, yes, that's probably where we'll be going after.
And garlic toast.
For lunch.
And the 12-ounce Bushwhacker beer, which, of course, there are choices. There are alternatives to that. And they've got veggie burgers and all that sort of thing.
But you know what? We need to tell the listeners that if they want an alternative, they have to let the ticket sellers know about it.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, okay. Okay, continue.
Okay, anyway, they're $25 in advance, and we have to have them purchased by Thursday, May 27th. That's the main thing. And you can call 586-1938 for tickets. Okay.
Okay.
All right. And once again, proceeds will go to Amnesty International to support human rights locally, nationally, and globally. So now we're going to wrap it up and close this week's Human Rights Radio and CJTR. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Mona and I are volunteers with Amnesty International, and our goal is to increase the awareness of and contribute to a discussion of human rights issues at home and around the world. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or check out our Facebook group at Amnesty International Saskatchewan and follow the links. Every day, in every moment, in every corner of the world, injustice cries out for your intervention. No one individual can respond to all the problems of the world, of course. To paraphrase a great humanitarian, if you can't help everybody, just help one. And whether the abuses stop immediately or take a long time to end, the gift of your attention and intervention can make a profound and positive impact on the ability of individuals and communities to endure and prevail. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."